So this is another talk, another day. Another day has gone past. The time is passing very quickly. But don't worry, you're one day closer to your enlightenment. It is a nice positive way of looking at it. Assuming you're going to become enlightened one day, that's one day of not being enlightened just passed away. Whoopee. So, in order to make that wonderful day come sooner rather than later, today's talk is going to be on insight. Insight, in other words, like learning how to understand, learning how to know, learning how to see. And this meditation retreat is not just watching the breath, it's also insight. For those of you who've done Vipassana retreats before, who've done Satipatthana retreats, when they say just do Satipatthana and that's the way to become enlightened, please understand that in the Anapanasati Sutta, when the Buddha taught the meditation on the breath, that's Anapanasati, he said anybody who fulfills the meditation on the breath also fulfills the four Satipatthanas. That's in the suttas many times. So if you fulfill this breath meditation, you are fulfilling Satipatthana. In other words, this is a Satipatthana retreat. If you're doing the job properly, it is. So there's no difference there, and that's actually just quoting the Buddha. And I can quote Ajahn Chah just at length. He always used to say, there is no difference between Samatha and Vipassana. There is no difference between breath meditation, insight meditation, Satipatthana, body meditation, whatever. We give it different names, but underneath, it's the same process. And you should be understanding that from your own experience by now. Because you'll notice the more calm you feel, the deeper you see. The slower you go, the more you understand. And as you calm this mind more and more, then that is the call for insight arising. And as insight arises, that's the cause for deeper calm. These two go together, working alongside one another. Ajahn Chah would say just the one side and the other side of a hand, the back and the front, which you cannot separate. What we would say is the two sides of the coin. You cannot separate them. One may be visible, but the other one is right behind. And that's precisely what the Buddha said. Because he said again and again and again, that the cause of wisdom, and what wisdom is insight, he called it yatha bhuta dasana. Yatha bhuta, as they are. Dasana, seeing. Seeing things as they are, as they truly are. Not seeing things as you imagine them to be, not seeing things as you want them to be, and certainly not seeing them as you don't want them to be. That's called denial. But seeing things as they truly are always comes as a result of calm and peace. So insight, seeing inwards, only comes from calm. It should be obvious to you when you realize that insight is the opposite of excite. So if you get excited, you can't get insight. It's either excite or insight. So if you get excite, there's no insight left anymore. You have to be really calm and calm and calm. If there's any English teachers here, you can take me to task afterwards. But not spelled the same, but it's a good joke. Anyway, you see, you're not excited, which is going out there in the world. You're going inside, and it means calm, calm. The Buddha said, from samadhi, from the peace. Samadhi patiya yata bhutiyana dasana. From samadhi, from that peace, from that tranquility, you start to see things as they truly are. It's fascinating, actually, to be part of that process of noticing the insight start to rise in the mind. Insight, again, like calm, is not something you do. You can't say, right, today I'm going to do insight. You're looking around, looking around, looking around, looking around. I'm going to do insight today. You never find anything that way, except just you get restless. And you can never really stay still on anything. The way you get insight is not doing anything again. insight comes to you, just like calm. It's just a natural part of the process. When the mind becomes still, you start to see things. You start to see things in ways you've never seen before. You start to see things as they truly are, not as you were taught they are, not as you expect they are, not as you want them to be. You start to see them as they truly are. And those experiences start to arise quite naturally. They've already started to arise with many of you. And the first sign of insight arising is when you're just walking in the garden. You just look at one of the flowers there. And they're just so amazingly beautiful. They capture your attention. You can stay with them for a long period of time. And you can really delight in the intricacies of their subtle features. And feel the bark of a tree, and it's full of texture. And you can compare that to what it was like when you first came in here. Flowers are flowers. How many flowers have you seen in your life? Just another stupid flower. That's a big deal anyway. Give me hay fever anyway. So when you get calm and peaceful, those things start to become interesting. They start to become incredibly beautiful, and you start to see far deeper into them than you've ever seen before. This is a sign that insight is arising. The story I usually tell, which was one of the first, probably was actually the first time when these things started to happen to me after my first retreat, and that was in Cambridge. I was a student there, and during the vacation period, we hired one of the boarding houses and used that as our retreat place. For 9 days. That was the first retreat I'd ever done. And not having a beautiful garden like we have here, being stuck in like a boarding house most of the day, the teacher allowed us to go for a walk for 1 hour every morning for exercise, good for your health. So when he told us, okay, after breakfast, or just before breakfast, go out for a walk. So I went down to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens, which I knew where they weren't that far away, about 5 minutes walk. So I went down there thinking that's a beautiful place to have exercise. You know, there's nice trees and gardens, and it's open early in the morning. Not many people went there that time in the morning. But when I got there, this Cambridge Botanical Gardens, I got to the entrance, and there was this clump of bamboo at the entrance. And I just looked at it, and it looked so beautiful. It looked so delightful. And I couldn't go any further. I stopped and stared. And as I stared, I saw deeper into that clump of bamboo. Just, you know, the texture. Have you ever noticed bamboo? It's like smooth, but it's almost velvety underneath. And sort of the young bamboo, the green, it's got no, almost like a dust on the outside there, which gives it this beautiful, like, as if it was like dusted with icing sugar. And just the way that the knots come up, it's just so graceful, almost like the spires of a church that comes out of the knots and then goes back again. It's so slender as it just moves up into the air, just bending with the wind, and these very lovely leaves just poking out from the side. And when the whole thing sways in the breeze, it gives us this rustle, which is just like some music by Vivaldi. And so when I was watching this, I was actually entranced. And I couldn't go further. And I did notice there was a bench close by, so I just sat myself down on the bench. I was supposed to be doing exercise, and just gaped at this clump of bamboo for so long that I realized I had to get back for breakfast. So I just left that clump of bamboo and just walked quickly back to get there in time. I was quite late. And the next day, because I hadn't really finished looking at that bamboo, I went there again. The same thing happened the next day. It was actually gorgeous, and just watching it all the time, seeing more and more. And you're getting so much joy out of just seeing and investigating a clump of bamboo. For 8 of those 9 days, I went to that same clump of bamboo, did the same thing, just sat down on a chair and just stared in awe. The other day, I went for a walk by the river. But even after 8 days, I still really hadn't thought I was finished. So after the retreat was over, when I went back to studies and all the busyness of student life, I had an afternoon free. So I thought, I'm going to go and visit my beautiful clump of bamboo to get off on that again, because I got so much joy watching it. It was beautiful. So I got on my bicycle, as students did in Cambridge, and just navigated your way through the busy traffic, which was quite stressful. And by the time I got to the botanical gardens and went to see this clump of bamboo, I was just so disappointed. It was just this ordinary, scraggly, dirty, sort of undernourished, sort of bent clump of bamboos. And it really shocked me. I thought, what's going on? Why did that entrance me for 8 days, for an hour every time, just a week or two ago, and now it's just completely boring? And I realized that it wasn't the clump of bamboo that was boring, it was my mind had been dulled by the stresses of the traffic and by student life. My mind wasn't bright. Its lights had dimmed just because of the number of things it had been doing in the last 2 weeks. And that's why I couldn't see any beauty or any depth in what was actually a wonderful piece of bamboo. And I realized that this is actually how insight arises. If you are moving so fast through life, if you're tired, if you've been doing so much, if you're stressed out, we all have a lot of stress. When that stress is very strong, it just dulls the lights of your mind. And insight just cannot really penetrate deeply. It's got no power. It's like looking at things in the darkness. You can see their shapes, maybe, but you certainly can't make out their details. You can't understand them to the fullness. But when you let go of this stress, you stop all this doing, you relax, you rest, you allow the energies of the mind to come up, and the knowing becomes bright. You go past the clump of bamboo. What most people would say is ordinary, and it's not outstanding at all. But because your mind is very bright and very beautiful, you see beauty in whatever. You see deeply into it. The beauty, the joy, holds your attention there, so it doesn't move. It's the glue which sticks the attention to the object long enough to bore and penetrate through. And whether it's a clump of bamboo, or the other thing which happens to me was the piece of concrete on my monastery in Thailand. Walking meditation during the rain retreat on this concrete floor, and I had to stop. I couldn't figure out what was going on, because that clump of bamboo became the most amazing, wonderful picture I'd ever seen. At the time, I thought it was so beautiful I should cut it out and send it to some art gallery somewhere. And this was just an ordinary piece of concrete which became a work of art. And why did that happen? It's just because my mind had become still. You can see the most ordinary of things, the most amazing detail of colour, shape, texture. The way those grays were arranged in the different shades on that little piece of concrete is the most gorgeous, wonderful, delightful picture I've ever seen. That's no joke or exaggeration. I was just transfixed. I don't know what the other monks thought I was doing. But later on, that concrete closed up and I couldn't see it anymore. It's now actually covered with plastic tiles. But you get quiet. They're just these ordinary plastic sort of tiles, the linoleum tiles they put on that thing, covered up that beautiful work of art. But now if you go walking then you get peaceful and quiet. My goodness, those are beautiful plastic tiles. But it's not the tile, it's not the concrete, it's not the flower, it's not the carpet in front of you. Sometimes you get a deep meditation, you open your eyes, wow, look at that. That carpet is jumps up at you and it's just so amazingly lovely. It's the mind which is doing this. The mind is getting joy. Joy holds your attention there, and the attention is long enough to see deeply into what's going on in there. We miss so much when we're rushing around so fast. So these are signs that you're ready for insight, or rather the insight is ready for you. The insight is ready to take you into a deep exploration of nature, of the way things truly are, not the way we see them in the dull greyness of our lives. We see them deeply. And in particular, it's not just seeing the nature of flowers, but that's delightful enough, you can do that. It's also seeing the nature of ourselves, especially the nature of what happens in the way to meditation. Because that's where insight should first be focused. Not really out there on the flowers and the trees. That's almost exciting again. the insight goes inside onto where you meditate. As I was mentioning throughout the whole of this retreat, is the insight goes in to that space between you and whatever you're experiencing. The relationship between you and what's happening now. That's the great place where insight can work. It's not what I'm experiencing it, but what am I, how am I experiencing it? And there you start to find what we call attachments in life. That's where you start to see the cause of all this trouble which we have. Not what we're experiencing as a problem. We may be in pain, we may be dying, we may be experiencing the death of a loved one. We may have lost all our money in the stock market. We may have been separated from our partner, they've run off with our best friend. Whatever's happening, that is not the problem. Even if you just won a lotto, you've just got a jhana, you think you're in line, it's not the experience. But what's between you and that experience, that's what insight really starts to uncover, some wonderful lessons. Because there, if you have an experience of enlightenment, and there's you, and you think, you put an am between I and enlightenment. I am enlightened. Now that is the problem. When you hold on to that, when you attach to that, when you put a screen between you and what you're experiencing, that is called attachment. You're tying yourself onto those things. Or the opposite. You just go back home and you find that you've been sacked from your job. You've been away for too long and someone else has got your job in Singapore. You know how hard it is to get your job in Singapore? Now that's the experience, painful, but what's actually between you and that experience? If it's that my job which has been lost, you tie yourself onto that pain, it's my pain. There, you've got attachment. And that's where the problem lies. Things come and things go. That's the impermanence of life. Jobs come, jobs go. Partners come, husbands go. Wives come, wives go. Children come, children go. Retreats come, retreats go. Coughs come, coughs go. The impermanence of all this sort of stuff. And actually, what are you doing with it? Now, when you put the insight there, you start to see what we call the hindrances and the defilements. This is what you're trying to uncover, just actually how they work. What is actually greed or lust, ill will, jealousy, fear? What are those things? A lot of times we only see the results of that fear, when they've done their work already, when it's too late, when we feel this terrible afraidness. That's not really what fear, you haven't seen it working, you haven't seen it get to you. The same as anger. What is actually anger? Where did it come from? How do you overcome that stuff? Or like lust or desire. Why do we have so much desire? We come here and we're good Buddhists, so we give up all our desire for material things, and then you sort of get angry at that person who takes the last piece of toast. The trend in the world. Now, see what's going on there? You see, because as soon as you see that piece of toast out there, so that's mine. I'll put my name on that. That's reserved for me. And you can see just how that attachment works. Now, it's you, this toast, and you move between the two of them, fill that up with a string, which you call mine. Now, when you start to see that relationship, you actually see it just happening just so often. Just actually how that you create suffering and problems for yourself in the world. You start to see greed, hatred and delusion. Actually, delusion is almost gone now because you start to see things working. Your attention's in the right place. And those defilements, those hindrances, they start to go as well. Because the biggest of those two hindrances is desire and ill will. And those desire and ill will stops you seeing things as they truly are. Desire means you see things not as they are, but as you want them to be. Ill will doesn't see things as they really are, but you don't see what you don't like. It's called denial. This is the problem. The best example of that, about why we don't see things as they truly are, is with your relationships, when you fall in love, or just before you fall in love, what actually happens? You take your partner to candlelit restaurants, to nightclubs, or out by the moonlight. Isn't that where you go romancing? You've all heard this before, but it's a very funny, it's very true. Why is it that you fall in love when it's dark? The reason is because when you can't really see what you're going out with, then it's possible to fall in love. You could really see who they really were. Turn up the lights inside and outside. If you could read their mind too. Oh my goodness, never again. But even though I say that, you know, to many, many Buddhists, they still go out for those candlelit they still go romantic to nightclubs. Why do they do that? Because we want to be deluded. We like the delusion. And that's, well, we don't really want to see things as they truly are. Just we want the idea of this beautiful romance, this wonderful boy, this wonderful girl, oh, she's so pretty, because you can't see your pimples under the candlelight. It's all delusion. And the scent just overcomes her body odour. It's all delusion. But we want that. And even when it's a movie, we know it's delusion, we know this is not real, but we still love going to those movies, especially the weepy ones. If we know what's going to happen, it doesn't matter. We pretend we don't know what's going to happen. Because we want to be excited, we want the delusion. And that's the trouble, because we want to be deluded. Very few people, you know, want to see the truth. And you can see that sort of in that little space there between you and what you're experiencing. You know, that sometimes you know that, you know, this is just a movie, this is false, this is deluded, but we still buy into it. Now when you've got really strong insight, then you just can't do that anymore. You see it so brightly. This is just the movie coming. Why am I just getting involved in this? You don't get that attachment anymore. You're breaking that down. So you can start to see those ties where the hindrances start to work. And you see that especially in this path of meditation, the insight happens on the path. And the calm insight, they work together. Because when you start meditating, you start, you know, maybe on the breath. And why is it it's hard to watch the breath when you first come in here? How many people have really managed to get hold of that breath? Okay, and I've told you, okay, now put your attention not on the breath, but on the space between you, you know, the one who's watching, and this breath business. And then you can see why you can't do it. Wanting, 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 doing, doing, doing. No, I don't want to sort of do it this way, I want to do it that way. It's all this wanting, ill will, which actually creates a problem there. And this is like, almost like a test, like an examination for you. Just like at school, or like university, your examinations are graded. The easy ones come first, and as you learn a bit more, you get a tougher examination. As you learn a bit more, the examination gets a bit more demanding. Because this is actually, you know, where you test yourself, where you actually you learn, you understand whether you've passed that test or not. So when it's with the breath, you see that gap between the one which is watching and the breath. And if you can actually pass that test and just let that controller go, just allow the breath to be, then you can find the breath is very smooth and peaceful. When the breath is smooth and peaceful, you pass that first test. You've done a bit of letting go. You're letting go of the coarser part of those hindrances, the desire and ill will. They're the main ones. Sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt, they're almost like a byproduct, like a form of desire and ill will. But once you've overcome those two at that stage, the breath becomes nice and peaceful. So, then what happens? Then you look at what's happening between you and that peaceful, beautiful breath. And then again, there's a lot of other desire. I want to go deeper now. How long have I got to watch this beautiful breath for? I've only got 2 or 3 days left. Ah! You can see expectation, desire, wanting there. So hindrance is working. And that's a more refined hindrance now. Or more refined form of that hindrance. You've got to see that and unlock it. So you are watching that beautiful breath and there's nothing between you. No expectation, no wanting, no tying you onto that experience. Or it may be that that beautiful breath always wants to develop, but you don't think you're good enough. It's another sort of sense of ill will between you and that experience. You don't want it to happen. Sometimes it's because of scariness. As I mentioned earlier, you notice that the more you develop this meditation, the more you have to let go of control. And sometimes that very idea is almost like letting go of ourselves. It's letting go of part of ourselves. Something which we're always so attached to, we're so used to, that it is like we're killing ourselves. It's like a spiritual suicide when we let go of the doer. And that for many people is very scary. Because for most of our life we thought that the doer was our protector. We've always viewed it as something which, if we can make it smart and form it and make it nice and strong, it will give us happiness, it will give us success, and it will protect us from any harm. Get that doer in control. That's why people think that they go crazy when they lose control. However, the opposite is true. And you see this with your insight. It's not what you expect. You don't expect that by letting go of control that you're as safe as anything. This is actually what happens. The more you let go, the more safe and stable you are. There's an old simile which somebody gave me in Melbourne several years ago. They asked me this question, which I now ask you. Why is it that when these birds, you've seen the birds outside, there's hundreds of birds outside in that garden. Where do they sleep at night? They sleep up on those trees. They roost. And those branches, some of them are very, very narrow. And sometimes at night the wind blows those branches backwards and forwards. Imagine that you went to sleep on a branch. Would you be scared of falling off? My goodness, you wouldn't sleep all night. You'd be clinging on all night. So how come those birds never fall off the tree? And they can still sleep and relax at the same time. And the reason is, it's the nature, the anatomy of birds, that their claws on their sort of their feet, whatever you call them, when they really relax, those claws close. The more that they relax, the more they close. When they let go fully, then they're fully holding on. And that's how the birds could actually sleep at night on those trees without falling off. If they had to put forth effort to hold on, they'd never be able to relax enough to go to sleep. But for those claws, they're so designed, the more they relax, the more stable they are. That's why they never fall off. In the morning, when they have to fly off, they have to put real effort to actually open up those claws. So human beings have to have the first cup of coffee before you can open up those claws. It's so hard for them to actually open up. But the more they relax, the more they close up. And that's exactly the same what happens with the mind. The more you relax, the more you let go, the more you give up control, the more stable and safe and secure you are. It's going the opposite direction for what you thought. And this is actually what you see in your insight. The more I let go, actually, the easier and the better it becomes. You get these insights into what letting go really is and why you should let go. Very often the people say, "I don't, Brahm, please tell me what letting go means, or tell me how to let go." And so I've been telling you that for the last 5 or 6 days. You say it this way, that way, backwards, forwards, up and down, until eventually people actually get the message and they see what it is. That's the insight comes up, what letting go is. Separating the one which knows from what's known. So there's no tie between there. Just you're letting it be, allowing it to happen. And the more you allow it to happen, it doesn't, what you know, it doesn't go off all over the place. If you just watch this wandering mind, just leave it alone, just watch it, with nothing between you and that wandering mind, no attachment at all. The more you let go, the stiller it becomes. You don't fall off the tree. You don't go wandering all over the place. If you have got a wandering mind, if you can't stop that train of thought, it's because you get aboard that train of thought. Just like the image, the metaphor of a train of thought, that train is going on the station. And you get right on top of that train. You get inside. You go for the journey. There is something between you and that object. It's called attachment. But if you can just stand that, thoughts over there, I'm in here, there's nothing between us, the insight goes in that gap and unties any knots there, then you're free. The train leaves, but you don't go with it. And when it's, you know, half a mile in the distance, it disappears. There's nothing in the station anymore. Emptiness, stillness. That is actually how it works. It's just the same way as those similes of going to the movies. I remember going to the movies with our friends when I was a student. Going to the movies, but always remember this occasion, went to see West Side Story, one of my favourite stories. West Side Stories, for those of you who are old enough to remember West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet, set in the Bronx in the 60s or 70s sometime. So there's these two gangs. Now, and of course, they were fighting each other, opposing gangs. I think one was Puerto Ricans, I think they were other Italians. And of course, one of the boys, I think it was from the Italian gang, no, from the Puerto Rican gang or whatever, they fell in love with a girl from the other gang. So it's one of these doomed love affairs, which ladies really like. I do. So with three or four of my mates, we took our girlfriends along, we all went together to see this movie. You know, to do sometimes as a student, you know, you take your mates and your girlfriends and they all go together. And we got to that final scene, which is memorable, where Tony was going to be shot by Maria's brother, because he was, you know, from the other gang. And you know, he killed some of the other ones. Well, it's complicated things in the movie. But anyway, Maria's brother was out there trying to shoot Tony. And Maria was trying to warn him, trying to find him, to warn him, my brother's coming to shoot you. Disappear. And Maria finally found Tony under this lamppost, but too late, because her brother also saw him and pulled the trigger. And the sound of a bullet sort of split the air of the New York night and hit him straight in the chest. As Maria went running towards him, but too late. She grabbed Tony, dying in her arms. With tears. I was going very, very well then. But actually, you did exactly what we did as boys. When they started to sing this song, there's a place for us somewhere, there's a place for us, and all the violins going. And then all the girlfriends, their tears were streaming down. And of course, what the boys did, exactly what you did, we laughed our heads off. It was so funny. But why did anyone get involved in that? Why the emotion? Even when I was saying that, I was trying to bridge that gap between what you were knowing, what you were hearing, and start getting that emotion involvement. Tears streaming. Almost maybe, but not quite. Now that's attachment. And as boys, we could see that. It was just a movie. Obviously, later on, we were attached and took our girlfriend's home. But this... but at the movie, you know, we were Buddhists. So, anyway. But you can see that attachment which we have there and why we like to get involved in that. And it's only a movie anyway, why? Why on earth, you know, do you sort of make yourself sad like that? Oh, because we want. It's so romantic. You see that attachment there. So when we actually meditate and you see those things, you see it's just like a movie. So we're watching this beautiful breath. It's just a beautiful breath, that's all. It's not my beautiful breath. It's not my movie. It's not my life on that screen. It's not my beautiful breath. So we stop that attachment there. We let it go. That way we don't try and make it deeper or change it or do anything with it. We just leave it alone. It's called letting go. Be content with it. We're just doing the meditation for the sake of doing it, not trying to get something out of it. Not doing business with what we're experiencing. We're not a business meditator. When you do business, you get the stress of business. So don't do business with what you're watching. I'll watch you if you give me chance. Okay, deal. So we just watch with no expectation, no business dealing. And then what happens is that the beautiful breath disappears. And we get these nimittas coming up. We pass another level of test. And then insight has to be sharper to pass the next test. Because between you and the nimittas is even more subtle attachments, more subtle defilements, more subtle hindrances. The hindrances haven't gone yet. They just come in their more subtle forms. And we've got to really look into this. At this particular point, there's one of these very subtle hindrances which comes up. Sometimes we call it like Mara's last stand, his last attempt to stop you getting into jhanas, which is called like reflection. Reflecting on Dharma and truth. Very often, people think that is insight. But in the suttas, the Buddha said, that is not insight. That is like Mara deceiving you. Because what happens, you get very, very, very still. You get this beautiful nimitta coming up. And you get your mind gets so powerful. You start like seeing all these amazing dhammas, all these amazing truths and insights coming up, flooding. And you think, wow, this is amazing, just what I'm understanding, what I'm seeing now. That is still delusion. You haven't got the full data yet. It's as if Mara, this person trying to stop you becoming enlightened, sees you're getting so close, okay, the only way to stop this guy or this girl getting into those jhanas and really sort of undermining my empire is actually to give them the delusion, their understanding Dhamma, their understanding wisdom, to give them the illusion that they're becoming wise. And so they throw all these little tempting tidbits of understanding at you at that particular stage. You can give yourself the most amazing Dhamma discourses at that particular stage. The insights just flow through you, and it's so amazing, you're understanding things, that's amazing, it's wonderful. Just the whole secrets of the universe are being revealed to you. It is a con. It's called Dhamma Vitaka, the lingering obstacle, to Samadhi Buddha called it. It's the last one which lingers when everything else is gone. When that nimitta comes up, be quiet. Don't even move. Any little dhammas come up to tempt you? Not yet. Any great insights come up? Oh, this is interesting. Stop it. Because that's one of the lingering defilements there. What's between you and that image becomes the investigator. It's not time to investigate yet. That is a hindrance. So when this comes up, you come to the stage, you get such great meditation that so many insights come up. You think you want to write a book. Another book on Buddhism, another book on insight, another book on all these amazing things. But you'll find that you get all those nice books, those nice ideas, but then again you go back home, and the first day back at work, you get argued about with somebody. You get upset with somebody. It's not the full thing. So be careful. It gets more controlling. A business deal trying to squeeze insights and wisdom. How does that experience? Leave it alone. Let it go. That last piece of controlling between you and that nimitta, that's where insight has to be very, very powerful and very, very sharp to be able to truly let it go. For example, one of the experiences which I had, that nimitta used to always be moving. I could never keep it still. It was bright and brilliant. It seemed to be plenty good enough to get into jhanas. It was amazing bliss and happiness, but it would never actually stay still. And I didn't really realize, how on earth can I get my nimitta to stay still? Until when you actually looked, you found out the reason why. After you experience familiarity, it's like gaining data, first of all, before you start thinking about it, discovered that that nimitta was like a reflection of my mind. I was actually seeing my mind, like you see a face in a mirror in the bathroom. That's a very, very good simile of what's happening there. And the image in the mirror, as it were, was moving all over the place. And what I was doing in this metaphor, which is very, very accurate, I was trying to hold the mirror still, so the image would be still. And I was holding the image, the mirror still, instead of holding the one which watches still. That's all I needed to do. That's why I could never steal that limiter for a while. I was holding the wrong thing. And after a while, he realized what that limiter was, the image of the one which was watching. So I stopped the one which was watching moving. The knower, mindfulness. I wasn't watching the image. I wasn't trying to keep the image still. The image, leave that alone. What I was watching, that could be as it was. It's the one which was watching. I made sure that didn't move. And if there's any slightest movement in the one which is watching, it was seen in the limiter movement. Because an exact image, a replica of the watcher. So when I understood that, it became quite easy to know what to do then, which was nothing. And keep the one which is watching absolutely still. Now there it has to be absolutely still. Any slightest bit of doing, slightest bit of wanting, slightest bit of business dealing, the slightest movement at all would make that limiter shake, and it would never be able to get into jhanas. As soon as you really let go, you are letting go of the doer to its fullness, the last bit of real letting go, then you could enter the jhanas. That insight there, you had to see the doer, and you had to see how it was still shaking the knowing. That's what we really mean by those five insights which get you into the jhanas. When you come out afterwards, it's not just the experience of jhanas, but the memory of the way you got in there, which is fascinating. Because there, when you're in the jhanas, you've got rid of most of the attachments which create the rebirth in samsara. The only attachment you've got left in those jhanas is the attachment which will stop you from becoming an arahat, you're just an anagami, just a non-returner. That just final tiny bit of attachment there, which is basically not all that much. But I've often said that many people will be satisfied in their life by becoming non-returners, by getting that, you know, third stage of enlightenment. You know, fourth stage of enlightenment, full enlightenment would be great, but third stage, I mean, that's pretty good. So it's a small attachment which is left. All the big ones, you've untied them for the time being, with to gain jhanas. So you're actually seeing what is actually stopping you becoming enlightened. And you've seen them because you've gone through them. If we haven't gone through them, then we haven't really seen them yet. We think, oh yeah, we can now. I can let go at any time, just decide I don't want to right now. So the person says, yeah, I can give up smoking. Any time I can give up smoking, it's just, you know, it's not convenient at this moment. What it means is they can't. The only way to prove that you can give it up is to give it up. Then you know you can give it up. Other times it's just delusion. So we think, yeah, I can give up sex any time, I can give up sort of going to parties any time, I can give up my attachment to my kids any time. I just don't want to right now because it's a bit inconvenient. I can meditate, I can go on a retreat any time, but this one is a bit that's just obviously delusion. We're just fooling ourselves. And this is actually where you test whether you really know those attachments and whether you really can overcome them by doing it. And you're giving up attachment to your body to gain those jhanas, because the body's disappearing. People say, oh, I'm not afraid of death, I'm not attached to my body, if I die today, that's fine. But if the angel of death comes in here, if I get someone, you know, they have this, in the movies now apparently, they've got this image of like this hooded person, just like one of the monks next door. They come in with a sigh, and you think it's the angel of death, it's just the gardener, that's all. But a lot of you would be scared stiff. Especially if they came in the evening just after the last talk. They just moved in here very slowly. And then they, oh my God, death is coming to me. And that's the only time you really know whether you're scared or not of death. When it starts to happen. Or whether you can give up your body in meditation. Because then it goes so completely, it absolutely disappears and you get into a jhana. Why? Can't we stop hearing those birds or that traffic outside? Cause of attachment, that's it. The attachment attached to sound. Why can't we just let the body disappear? Because this is ours. If I let it disappear, if I'm not looking after it, something's going to go wrong. If I'm not sort of, you know, every now and again just checking out to see where it is and what it's doing. You know, somebody might pinch it and steal it, and I've got no body left. I might get possessed by another spirit if you meditate and you're not really watching what's going on. Perhaps some terrible ghost or demon will come to take over your body. Does that scare you? Don't scare me. Clear my body if it likes. I'm not using it. What's the big deal if it's not yours? I've often said, you know, because I was brought up a sort of a Christian, but certainly in a Christian culture. And the most scary of things in that Western culture was actually the devil coming to take over your mind, or selling your soul to the devil. That was the worst possible crime you could possibly do, sell your soul to the devil. Now, being a Buddhist, if the devil came here and offered me some money for my soul, say, deal. Give the money to the nuns monastery and you can take my no self. There's nothing in here to take. But you see what fear actually is. Fear is actually not really understanding what the truth is. But this is where you're testing. So often, you know, I say that getting into jhana is training yourself how to die, how to let go of your body, because that's what happens when you die. When you die, you have to give up your five senses. You can't see, hear, smell, taste, you can't even feel your body anymore. It's gone. For many people that's scary, because that's all they've ever known in their whole life. Seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, the body, being. That for them is being. They haven't got much ideas in the world of the mind, so much so that they don't even think you exist after you die. So all this which they know, the whole world has been taken away from them. That's scary for people who believe in such things as only the body. But in meditation, in jhana meditation, we're training ourselves to let go of the five senses. And what happens when people die and they come back afterwards to have out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences? What do they say? They say they go floating out of the body to the light. Now, do you recognize what that light is? Nimitta. When the senses disappear, remember that symbol I gave them, the two hands, the senses, the five senses go down, the mind starts to become prominent. And that manifests as a beautiful light. That's what happens when you die. When your five senses really turn off because of death, because the body stops. The mind becomes prominent, has to become prominent, it's the only thing left. That's where you see the light, and you go towards that light. This is what's happening. Same thing which happens in that state of meditation. Exactly the same. Your light is very beautiful and brilliant, it means you've done and had a good life. A pure person. This is checking what you're going to see when you die. And if it ain't nice, you better be doing some more work while you've still got the time. That is letting go, it's just dying. Jhana meditation is training how to die. And as you are letting go more and more, as you are dying more and more, this is where you get your insights. Where you are attached. What stops you from dying gracefully? What stops you letting go? Why letting go is so hard? What these attachments truly are. And also you get the insight of what happens when you do untie them and let them go. You get the insight into happiness. Because every time any one of you has let go a tiny bit, you get a huge reward of peace and happiness. It feels so good. If you really let go and go into a jhana, that blows you away. That's the happiness better than sex. Hugely better than sex. You get an insight into one of the most important aspects of the world. Suffering and happiness. This is where you understand the Four Noble Truths. Somebody asked the other night, how do you understand the Four Noble Truths? When it says, you know, the life is suffering, people say, how can you Buddhists say that? Are you really, really screwed up? Have you never seen like a baby being born? Have you never listened to Beethoven's Fifth by one of the great orchestras in the world? Now, haven't you seen like the sunset, you know, over the Indian Ocean at night? Have you ever fallen in love? And said, you haven't experienced things yet. And you say, listen mate, you haven't experienced things yet. You experience a jhana, you know what we're talking about. Because when you experience the jhana, it's much more powerful than falling in love. Beethoven's fifth is just a lot of noise. It is. Oh, no, Beethoven's fifth, da 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 da. The pleasure, the beauty, the power, just, you know, the whole thing is much greater. And no sex, there's been many, many years since I've had sex, I mean over 30 years since I last had sex when I was a lay person. But you still remember those experiences, you remember what meditation was like. That's one of the reasons I became a monk. You have that, you have this, I'll take meditation any day. Now what you're learning here is when they say that, you know, the monks or the Buddhists say, you know, just all this stuff which people get off on, sort of in the world, there's a lot of suffering. This is not a theory. It's not because you just read it in the books or because you believe it because you're supposed to be a Buddhist. Yeah, all life is suffering. Now, I'm supposed to say that because I'm a Buddhist, but I don't really believe it. Let's see the next movie. You seen Lord of the Rings yet? Whatever it is, because, you know, people think that's happiness, and that's what we go for, and that's what we spend most of our life doing. But when you know jhanas, when you know the end of the body and the end of those five senses, and the insight just works on that experience, you've got that data, you find all that you've been taught and expected to be happiness is not the real thing. There's this beautiful simile which the Buddha gave of this blind man who was sold a cloth by one of the merchants. He said, it's a beautiful white cloth made of Benares cloth, like this famous silk in the time of the Buddha. Absolutely the best possible cloth you can have. It's so beautiful, so expensive, it costs a lot of money, but if you want it. And the blind man said, oh yeah, I'd like that. And so he paid this merchant a lot of money for this beautiful, clean, white, perfectly woven Benares cloth. And he went around so happy, he's got this beautiful, you know, shirt to wear. And then after some months, he finds a doctor, and the doctor says, I've got a special medicine which can heal your blindness. And he does heal that blindness. And then he looks at his shirt, and it's this old, dirty old rag. And he finds he's been sold something which wasn't true. He said he'd be upset and angry that he bought something which was not what it was meant to be. And the Buddha said in the same way, that we've been sold a happiness which is really just like a dirty old rag compared to what a real white Benares cloth is truly like. We've been sold happiness of sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches. Because we're blind to anything else, we think, oh, what a wonderful life I'm having, how happy I am. We only know what is actually an old rag. But once, you know, that monk or nun comes along and puts that potion on your eyes and you get into jhanas and you see, you open your eyes of your mind for the first time, you see what you've been sold. My goodness, what have I been doing all of my life? Looking for sex, looking for nice food, going here, going there, listen to music. And it's not what you thought it was. That's called insight. Changing the way you look at the world. So all those things of the world, they don't move very much to you anymore. You realize they're just old dirty old rags, which have been sold by Mara and Co. The great deceivers, the con artists, the dotty brothers of Buddhism. The one that you see that, then you've got the insight, and then of course you're not attached to that world anymore, you're letting go. Now that's what real insight truly is. It's like you've been born in a prison, raised in a prison, spent all your life in a prison, it's been dark in there, and you're used to that prison. And even though someone opens the door and says, you can go out, if you stayed in that prison too long, you don't want to go out. You're afraid to go out. You're comfortable and you're used to prison, even with all its sufferings and even with all its pains. At least it's pain, you know. And then someone says, come on, come out. And we entice you out. You're enticed out of your jail. What with? The pleasure of jhanas. Outside that door is a pleasure better than sex, you know. Beautiful, it's orgasmic out there. After a while, you think, oh, should I? And then you do it. And you realize it is true. You come out of the jail of suffering, the jail of attachment to the five candles. So when the Buddha said those five candles, what are the five candles? The body, feeling, disorder with sensory feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. When he said that, was suffering. Now you're understanding why. You're getting insight from your experiences, and that is challenging. Because you have to, automatically it changes your life. The way you look at life, the way you deal with life. You get a jhana, and you understand what's going on. You should be not afraid of death anymore, because you've died. You've died to the body, you've come back again. Jhana is like a near-death experience. And afterwards you realize what goes on when you die, you should be not afraid of death. Not afraid when other people die, not attached to people. When somebody dies who's very close to you, you won't cry. If the telephone rings and it's from a close relation and they want to speak to you, they say that, you know, that a close relation of yours, only 23 years of age, has died. And you say, I expected that. What do you mean you expected that? I've just been run over by a lorry, by a truck. And you say, I expected that. I expect people to die at any time. Nothing comes as a shock to you. Can you do that? If you do, you've got insight, you understand what's going on. If you're not, you haven't understood what's been being said about life. It's only the body which dies anyway, so big deal. Why are we attached to bodies? Have you got children? Have you got parents? Have you got brothers and sisters? Have you got friends? Or have you just got bodies you're attached to? When you get insight, you start to see all these things, and the whole thing unravels. And when it unravels, so does suffering unravel. So as insight grows, so does peace, so does happiness. And that's how you can tell whether you have insight. You can't tell when you've got insight whether you can give great talks, whether you can talk to your friends and discuss the most refined parts of Dhamma meditation and insight and whatever. I've seen many people like that. They give amazing talks. They're just so inspiring. And afterwards they come with stupid things. And they cry and they get emotional, they get angry, they get upset. It's all words. It's not really coming from experience. If it really is insight, it produces calm. Whatever happens in life does not disturb you. You're even. That's the meaning of the word samana, the word which covers monks, nuns, or holy people, even one. Someone, no matter what happens to you, you're at peace. Insight is known by how much peace it gives you, not many how many words it gives you to talk to others. Insight is what produces peace. So if you get these great insights, oh, you're just so calm. It's like this whole burden of work which has made you move has been removed. It's like a telephone on your desk has been disconnected. It never rings again. You're peaceful, still. The sign of insight is calm. And the sign of calm is insight. So if you want to know how wise you are, and how much you understand these teachings, it doesn't really, questioning you about them is not the point. That's not the measure. The measure of how much you understand these teachings is how still you can become, how peaceful you are. And the measure of how peaceful you are is not when you bliss out in jhanas. The measure of how peaceful you are is how much insight comes up. Calm is measured by insight. Insight is measured by calm. That's why the two will always go together. So, as you're going through this retreat, you can have all these amazing insights coming up, and calm and insight coming up. But remember that big obstacle just before you get into jhanas. Don't go thinking about Dhamma. That's not insight. That's just proliferation, just at the very end. Mara's the last little ploy to stop you getting into those jhanas. When you get very still, not the right time to think about Dhamma yet. Be quiet, be still. And put all that insight, especially, into what's happening between you right now and what you're feeling. What is the connection between you and this talk? Now that's where you find insight. And that's when you unlock the attachments you have to the experiences of life. That is where you let go. Okay, so that's the talk today on insight. Any questions about that?
John, the thing about controlling in deep meditation and is one moves away from that stance of controlling and gain success in limits and jhanas and all that sort of stuff. Is there a parallel process that spontaneously occurs in one's life as well? I'll give you an example of what I mean. I work for myself and I happen to kind of like a generate business or something like that, and you know, there's a sort of an idea that you should get a business plan and work A, B, C, D down the plan or something like that. But there's another part of me that functions professionally where I'll just have intuitions about contacting this person or thing that person, and I don't really know how it works, but it works. But there are two different sort of contrast things about like a control way of going about stuff, this spontaneous thing. Does the process we're talking about here, is there a parallel in one's life?
There is a parallel in one's life. The more quiet one gets, the less one controls in life. The less one controls oneself, the less one controls others. One becomes a more compassionate person, a more loving person towards others. Because you know the opposite of being a loving person is when you're with another person who controls you. Wants you to do this, wants you to do that, and they use anger as a means of control. They use it to make you afraid, or to, you know, whatever. And they guilt as a way of control. Now what do you mean you don't want to go out with me this evening? You know, don't you really love me? So it's all like guilt again. So they use these as a way of controlling each other, but when you get very peaceful and deep in your meditation, you don't control others. You become a much more loving person, and people actually like to be with you more. So, you know, you control because you want people to be around, but that actually forces them away. When you're compassionate, then they come towards you. When you let go, you stay on the tree. When you cling, you keep falling off. This is one of the problems. So you learn actually just the joy of just letting go of non-controlling. At all aspects of life, even your business will probably go much better. And you relax a lot more. Yeah? Wish that we get the jhana or the sex. Sorry about that. That's the end of the bell. Sorry. So what we actually I do apologise. No, that's my fault. No, I apologise for being cheeky. What actually happens is that this is something which is down the track, which one will experience. But until that time, if one doesn't know jhana, then that's all one knows, and then one tries to make the best of it. So making the best of it means if you're going to have a relationship, have a good one, a non-controlling relationship. And that way, and have sort of in the relationship of intimacy without fear. Because again, a lot of fear comes up in sexuality, and that creates too many problems at all, and too much controlling. So if you can actually, you know, do some of these things which you've done here, but just no controlling, let go, flow, then you actually find you have a much better time in a relationship. You probably had enough relationships now, and that person's tried to dominate you, or you try to dominate and control them, and it doesn't work. After a while, the whole thing sort of, you know, falls apart. Because it's not really another full love. Love is always the ability to let the other person go, not controlling them. So it's unconditional love. And if you give that love, then they stay with you much longer. Because they like to be there. There's an old, I haven't mentioned this yet, this is that story from the Chinese art of war about the general who had the best discipline in the whole imperial army of China. And the emperor wanted to find out why, and the general said, "I only tell my soldiers to do what they want to do. Just like me. I've only told you to do what you want to do all week. You can sleep whenever you want, you can meditate whenever you want." And they said, "Well, how come," said the emperor, "do your soldiers get up so early? Do they train? And they're so good at, you know, battle?" It's called motivation. So you motivate yourself, or I motivate you, to want to get up early for meditation, to want to let go. And then you just do it. You don't have to force. This is actually how sort of have good relationships. Not force, not control. The other person is motivated from the love to want to be with you. But you don't tell them what to do. You don't order them. It's the same with looking after kids. People always keep on complaining about their children. "Oh, my children never do what they're told. They stay out late at night. They do stay in their bedroom. They're just watching the computer all the time. They don't do their homework. They don't do what mum and dad tells them. La, 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 la." And I usually talk to them about the law of karma. I say, "Well, what did you do when you were that age? This is your karmic return." Now you have to know what it's like. But more than that, I said that children can be taught. They have to be taught not just in a direct way, being controlled, but actually just being guided, being loved. If you give a child freedom, then the child will stay at home. Stay within your boundaries. It's just the psychology of doing it. But with those pleasures of the world, that I've been talking today about sort of the deep meditations and the deep insights, this is actually what happens. But it takes a while to actually get those deep insights. Now be surprised. Now you'll find, just some experience, when you get into meditation, you do get experiences which, my goodness, it is true, they are better than sex. But you don't know that, you can't imagine that, and you can't even believe it yet. So don't believe these things until one knows them for oneself. But it gives you an idea of what we're doing here, and why. Hi. Hi. Okay. So, any questions about that?
I think it's going on from that question a little bit. For those that are in relationships, big relationships, and have marital, small marital relationships, as part of the duty of marriage. Is it also still possible in that situation? I'm imagining it must be, because you're teaching lay people here.
Yes,
I am. I'm assuming you don't want us all to become monks and nuns and have no procreation in the world.
No comment.
Can you still, with meditation,
you have a better relationship. It gets better and better. Less fear, less control, less ill will, more peaceful, more sensitive. It gets better and better.
But you can still, just for those of us who still have some craziness in us, you can still have certain limits. You can still perhaps reach the stage. You can still go towards that path.
No, but as you go towards the path, just attachments, ways of looking at the life fall away. You don't make them fall away. You don't think, now I'm going to give that away, now I'm going to give this away. It just happens. It's the natural path. Just, you know, when the mango tree flowers, it's so beautiful flowers, and the flowers fall off. If they didn't fall off, there'd never be the mangoes which come afterwards. And the mangoes fall off. If they didn't fall off the trees, you'd never be able to enjoy them. As long as letting go happens, quite naturally, tonight. And as we let that go, we just have more beautiful experiences. And when you were young, you had your dolls and teddy bears, you let go of those and have live ones. Or a husband. After all that disappears. Yeah, go on. If you do sit in the cave for 10 years and you get into deep meditation, actually you learn even much more. So actually it's good to actually sit in the cave for 10 years. How many people have done that? Because you're learning about yourself. Sometimes with relationships, actually you're out there too much, concerned with the object of your relationship. If you actually spend more time actually seeing what's between you in that relationship, the connection, the fear, the wanting, the desires, the hoping, the need, the sense of identity you should get from that relationship. See those sorts of things. And then you find, have a relationship's fine, don't have a relationship, that's fine. Both are okay. And in the end, that we'll all our relationships eventually end. Eventually we die by ourselves. Your relationship, your last one, is with your first one, is with you. So much of your life will be lonely, even with other people around. I often say the last person you say goodnight to before you go to sleep is not the person laying next to you in bed. It's you. The first one you see in the morning when you wake up. Here I am again. It's you. That's the most important relationship. Okay, thank you for all those questions, because I'm just nudging the clock. I do actually look at the clock sometimes. And it's interview time. So, those of you got your names down for the interviews, please come in. I think there's only two people across their names out, so people can try and be on time and try and keep it to just meditation, 10 minutes each. Okay? And enjoy not doing anything.